Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Since the origin of our species, humans have hunted wild animals for food, often less powerful than the animals. We learn teamwork, strategic planning, and community sharing from the hunt. With aristocracy came private ownership of wildlife. The poaching of the king's pheasant was a hanging crime. In the United States, the public has a trust responsibility for wildlife, an outgrowth of immigrants learning from native peoples that wild meat and fish meant survival, and later, the near extermination of species by hunting for commercial gain. And today, with 300 million Americans, vast cities and suburbs demanding energy and factory-produced food, what is left of the ancient hunt in wild land? Land Tawney knows something about this. He's president of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Land, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Tell us about your background. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
So I'm lucky enough to be a fifth-generation Montanan. First family member was born in Montana in 1872 in Stevensville. I grew up here, and so I grew up on my father's back, you know, fishing. I grew up in the Cinnabar Basin chasing elk with him, where I would literally have to walk in his footsteps because the snow was so deep. My mother and my father were both the first full-time environmental lobbyists at the state legislature here in Montana.
Who were they working for?
They had started the Montana Environmental Information Center, and so that's what they were working for. And it was back kind of during the mid-70s when a lot of clean air and clean water stuff was happening, when we rewrote our constitution here in the state.
Right, sure. It had a right to a clean and healthy environment.
Exactly. So I got to grow up kind of around both the hunting and fishing background. My father ended up going to law school later in life and was the Elk Foundation's lawyer for the first 10 years of their existence until he passed away. And he was, you know, very involved in conservation easements through them, but also all over the state. And so I got to see that side of things. He was also the executive director of the Democratic Party at one point, and actually when I was born in 75. And so I got to see the political side of things too. So I've got a pretty diverse background, at least from my parents.
Where'd you go to school?
Went to a year of school out in Seattle, and then that's when my father got sick, and so I came home and ended up finishing my degree in wildlife biology at the University of Montana.
In studying wildlife biology with that extensive background in the family, did you learn anything you didn't know?
Good question. I think I learned a lot about systems and ecology, and so that all parts matter. I mean, I think that's where I first found out about Aldo Leopold, and not just the megafauna, the elk and the deer are important, which they totally are, but also the songbirds and the great gray owls, they all kind of play a role. And so I think that's something I definitely learned.
When did you graduate?
2000.
Then what?
I started volunteering for a young organization called the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Alliance. At that point, it was Bob Munson, who had helped start the Elk Foundation, was creating this organization, really to look at kind of public lands and kind of roadless rule in particular. And so I volunteered for them, then worked into a part-time job and then a full-time job where I was running their national grassroots programs. Before I left, I worked for them for 3.5 years. Got the opportunity to work with a man named Jim Range, who actually had a place just north of town here on the Missouri, but learned a lot in that tenure with them.
What's a lot?
I think I learned a lot about grassroots activism. You know, I didn't go to school for grassroots activism. Learned how to engage people both at a local level and at a national level.
Engaging local people, I assume that means getting them involved in your organization, working in concrete terms for some mission, fair?
Yes.
Or project.
Yes.
How do you do it? What's the key?
Just like anything else, I think it's about relationships. And so first you find out really what matters to people. When you get down to that conversation, and especially when that conversation tends to go to public lands and the experiences people have on public lands, I think you meet them there first, and then you talk about the opportunities to help protect and kind of enhance those public lands. And so then you make it easy for them. And I think, you know, whether that's making a phone call to an elected official, writing a letter to the editor, I think that first entry point and making it as easy as possible helps breed more success, especially when they get a good feedback loop that they made a difference.
I'm hearing that personal interaction, assessing the person where they're coming from, and a personal relationship is key.
I would say for long-term activism, for sure. I think you can, you know, push a button and not talk to people personally, and they can, you know, maybe take action. But for, you know, them to really get engaged, I think that personal interaction is definitely key.
How long did you work with the Theodore Roosevelt Organization?
It's about 3.5 years.
Then what?
And I had the opportunity to go to work for the National Wildlife Federation, organization I admired for a long time. They were established in 1935 by Ding Darling, who really saw what was happening to the prairie at that point, and really worked with hunters all over the country to form an organization of grassroots-based hunters to combat, at that point, the lid that had come off the prairie and trying to put that back on.
That sounds like something that's easier said than done.
Yeah, I think that, you know, through agricultural practices and then the establishment of the duck stamp, you know, the duck stamp was dollars coming from hunters so that they could hunt every year that then went into conservation. And so the combination between, I think, agricultural practices and then conservation measures through not only taxes like the duck stamp or, you know, like a fee as through the duck stamp or excise taxes like through the Pittman-Robertson Act that was established in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was 1937. Through those combinations, we were able to put the lid back on the prairie, and really that's a success story that we should all revel in.
It's an important point. What's your experience with the knowledge of sportsmen and conservationists who might not be hunters or anglers about the role of this federal legislation over time in protecting and conserving habitat? Do they know about it? Do they not know about it?
I think it's one of those best-kept secrets, you know. I think there's folks within the conservation sportsman's community that know this story, but I think the average hunter or shooter or even conservationist does not know that story. And it's unfortunate, you know, millions and millions of dollars each year are put back into, you know, state agencies because of that excise tax or with the duck stamp, you know, used to either enhance or create new national wildlife refuges all over this country.
And land and water conservation is general fund money, is it not? Or
land and water conservation fund money comes from, it came from 1964 from some offshore oil.
That's right, that's right.
And so it's a excise tax basically on oil and gas that goes for conservation all over the country.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Land Tawney, president of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So from the Roosevelt Organization, you went where?
Went to the National Wildlife Federation, and I started there as a regional rep. So I was working in Montana, Idaho, North Dakota, and South Dakota.
What does a regional rep do?
I worked with their state affiliates, so like the Montana Wildlife Federation, the North Dakota Wildlife Federation, and work with them on local issues, help them engage on national issues, and then really help them kind of build their capacity infrastructure at a state level.
Capacity and infrastructure may not mean much to people. What are we talking about?
Building membership and engaging leaders. So I think, you know, membership gives you more clout because there's more people to stand up and behind you. The engaging leaders, really, you know, leaders are who get the jobs done. And so finding those people was an important part of the health of those organizations.
Now, when you talk about getting the job done, that sounds like a political process in the sense of the more people you got, the more effective you can be. Am I right?
Very much so.
Can you give me some examples?
The one I like to tell you is towards the end of my career at National Wildlife Federation, when there was, you know, there's the Mississippi River Delta. The Mississippi River Delta has been dying since the 70s when they levied that river, and all the dirt and water from Montana gets pushed out into the Gulf instead of the marsh. And so it dies at a rate of about a football field every half an hour. And so here's this huge resource, especially for me as a duck hunter, where 70% of the waterfowl in North America winter in the marshes of Louisiana. As that disappears, so disappears that habitat, so disappears the robustness of those populations. So a direct correlation to, you know, living up here in Montana. That's a $1 billion kind of problem. And so we had a hard time kind of convincing Congress that was money they should utilize. And then the oil spill happened that we all are kind of well aware of, the BP oil spill, and very tragic situation. You know, 18 people lost their lives. But what it did is it created this opportunity for funding to help restore that Mississippi River Delta. We worked with Senator Landrieu out of Louisiana to help put a piece of legislation down called the Restore Act that would take money from the Clean Water Act kind of penalties and make sure that went back to restoration. A great idea. The country was definitely behind it, but was having a hard time finding a vehicle out in Washington, D.C. And so that's when we started talking to Max Baucus senator from Montana who was the chairman of the Finance Committee, and trying to figure out what we could do to get this important piece of legislation passed.
Now, we being the Wildlife Federation.
Wildlife Federation. So that was folks from all over the country. You know, I'm living here in Montana, but we were running a national kind of program, and so folks from Montana, folks from Louisiana, folks from literally all over the country that were working on that. We were working very closely with Ducks Unlimited on that campaign as well.
Now, somebody might say, we pay those people to be back there. They have staff. What is somebody from Montana, Louisiana, duck hunter, bird watcher, goes to Washington and wants to make a difference, give me a break? Someone might say that people couldn't have influence. There's big paid lobbyists. What's your experience?
I would say two things to that. I say that the first thing is that folks from back home are voters. And they also have relationships that are important to the elected officials. And so in the case of this BP oil spill and trying to pass this legislation, we had a relationship with Senator Baucus, and then we brought in somebody that had a relationship with Senator Landrieu from Louisiana. He was a charter captain from down there. He runs Cajun Fishing Adventures. He came into town, and we were able to work back and forth between those offices, find a solution, and ultimately get the Restore Act attached to the transportation bill, ultimately passed and through. There's been some legal kind of questions back and forth, but just in the last couple months, that case has been settled, and $19 billion, with a B, are now going to go back to help restore the Gulf of Mexico, in particular the Mississippi River Delta. So big money, which was needed, and kind of a silver lining that was found that would not have happened without a gentleman in particular from Louisiana.
It's an amazing story. So what leads you to backcountry hunters and anglers?
So I was very happy with my work at National Wildlife Federation and, backcountry hunters and anglers. I'd watched them since they started. And
when did they start?
So they started in 2004 around a campfire in Oregon.
Good place to start.
I think all our problems in the world should be solved and can be solved around a campfire, especially if there's a little libation probably included, which definitely happened that night. And so these folks got around this campfire, and they said, there's all these great, hunting fishing organizations that are out there, the Elk Foundation, the Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, and they all do great habitat species-specific work. A majority of that is done on private lands, and so there's really nobody really focused on public lands and the backcountry in particular. The backcountry is something that we're not making any more of in this country. It's those places that you can still go that look the same, feel the same, and you can experience the same things that Theodore Roosevelt did, even those before him. There's kind of these last bastions of public land. And so the organization was formed to protect and enhance those public lands, and particularly the backcountry.
So that's 12 years ago.
Yep.
And you I've been watching it, you said.
I've been watching it since their inception. It was all kind of grassroots driven, so all kind of people just word of mouth stepping up, and that's the way the organization went until 2010 when the organization first got staff, and that was just some part-time staff. And then I came on 3 years ago, spring of 2013, and at that point we had two part-time staff. I came on first permanent staff, and we've grown now into 15 staff, 9 of which are permanent, 6 are part-time. And so, we've come a long ways probably in those 3 years, but the founding and the kind of the mission that we came up with back in 2004 around that campfire couldn't be more true today, and I think that's why we're having so much success here recently.
Let's start with some definitions. What's backcountry?
Oh, that's good. I think, I think that's different in a lot of places of this country. We have members in all 50 states. Chapters in 24 states, just brought on new ones in Michigan and Wisconsin, but we've got one in Pennsylvania and New York. And so backcountry in the East may look different than it does, here in Montana. The Bob Marshall's 1.1 million acres. I'm going to Alaska next week, and that backcountry makes the Bob Marshall look small. And so what I think, though, that does bind kind of those smaller parcels of public land and even private land in the East that is accessible is to Montana and then to Alaska, is the solitude and the challenge and the adventure that those lands provide. And so, I think about water in particular. Anytime I'm on a piece of water on a river, I kind of disappear there, and that's my backcountry. Mm-hmm. And so that can be right next to a city, that can be right next to a highway, but I don't ever hear that once I'm on the water. And so I think it's a state of mind almost, this backcountry idea. again, I think, you know, it's different and probably to different people and in different parts of this country. But really, again, it's that solitude, the challenge, and kind of experience of the hunt that you can really only have on those lands.
Well, obviously, the people around the campfire felt that in one way or another, that backcountry and the experience it gives was threatened, and they set about to do something about it. What did they try to do? A, what are the threats, or what were the threats then? Have they changed now? Let's talk about that.
You know, I describe our work in probably three ways, and so I think there's threats and opportunities within all those. The first one would be access and opportunity. And so, you know, you have all these public lands that make America unique from anybody else in the world. You kind of described that, you know, at the beginning of the show, is that, you know, folks came to the United States and wanted something different. And what we have is different than anywhere else, where the public lands belong to the people and the wildlife belongs to the people. And so, first part about access and opportunity, we want to make sure that those public lands are there in perpetuity. Right now, in particular, there's folks that would like to sell public lands to pay off the national debt, or they would like to transfer them to the states so that they can extract more resources from them and think about short-term kind of economic gain versus long-term sustainability. And so that's a huge threat, I think, that's right now to that kind of opportunity piece. I would say within that as well is that, you know, we're looking at things. We already talked about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. That has helped pay for 70% of the fishing access sites here in Montana, which is a little known fact. And so you think without that fund, what would our access be like to our rivers? Where would that economy be that's driven around kind of our fly fishing kind of economy here in Montana and just people wanting to live near rivers? And so that access too is vitally important. And, you know, you think about, I guess the other issue I would bring up is here in Montana, we have a lot of inaccessible public land. You know, whether that's checkerboarded in the east or completely donated, where you have private land completely surrounding public land. And so it's inaccessible. And, you know, to me, that's our public land, and we need to find ways to work collaboratively with private landowners to find access to that. So that's our first bucket.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Land Tawney, president of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. That's obviously a big mission, just the first, what you call the first bucket, access and opportunity. What was the volunteer-based backcountry hunters and anglers able to do versus now you've said you got 15 staff?
15 staff, 9 permanent.
Okay, so what's the difference in the real world of the impact backcountry hunters can have?
I think the biggest impact I'd call out one staff member in particular. Her name's Katie McCaleb. She's our communications director. And so prior to her coming on last year, you know, we really were more reactive with the press, and we do letters to the editor and op-eds and things like that, but it was not systematic. And I would say bringing her on last February, we've gotten more press and been able to enhance the voices of our grassroots, boots-on-the-ground folks all over this country more in the last year than we did in the first 11 of this organization. And so that's just one asset that we've been able to provide to our members to make sure that their voices are being heard on all sorts of public lands issues.
And is your experience that having voices heard makes a difference?
Oh, for sure. That's really why our organization was established, is to be the voice for, you know, our wild public lands, waters, and wildlife. You know, let's take the Malheur occupation that happened here earlier this spring over in Oregon. We were able to take that situation and be able to really frame kind of how people were talking about that. And if you remember, when the folks who got there and took over the refuge first got there, they started talking about, we want to give this land back to the people.
Yeah, this was that vigilante action.
The Bundy bunch,
right,
who
okay.
took over the refuge.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they said, we want to give this back to the people. Well, my first question was, we already own that land. That's a National Wildlife Refuge. That belongs to all Americans. So what people are you bringing that back to? And so through media, we were able to kind of change that whole dynamic on how, you know, national mainstream was talking about it, and then also get that through, you know, to hunters and anglers all across this country. Sometimes when you hear, you know, the federal government is overreached and they're, you know, I don't have opportunity, they just don't know what they have. And, you know, when you start talking to them about how National Wildlife Refuges were established, this one was set aside in particular by Theodore Roosevelt, our duck stamp dollars have helped grow this refuge and enhance it. And so now it's this great place to go hunt and fish waterfowl. There's some upland birds there, great fishing opportunities. And so, once they found out about that opportunity and that it belongs to everyone in America, that whole dynamic changed. And so I think that's a real concrete example of something that we've done recently where the power of the media helped change the whole conversation.
You said bucket one. That sounds like there's more than one bucket.
There is. We've got three buckets. And our second bucket is backcountry conservation, which is a pretty encompassing bucket. But that ranges from our collaborative work that we do on place-based campaigns, and I'll give you a couple examples in a second, to large things out in Washington, D.C., like the Clean Water Act, that has implications for a lot of public lands all across the country. So the first piece in our kind of collaborative work, we work here in Montana, we're working on the Rocky Mountain Front, we're working up the Blackfoot, on kind of collaborative efforts that have both wilderness, increased timber harvest, and kind of keeping landscapes the way they are. My best example probably would be in central Idaho in the Clearwater Basin, where we've been working with timber folks, off-road vehicle folks, county commissioners, other conservation organizations, and looking at that Clearwater as a large landscape and trying to figure out how we manage that land in a productive manner. And so after about a decade of collaborative work, we've come up with an agreement, and that agreement includes 500,000 acres of new wilderness, 200 miles of wild and scenic river, 200 miles of the longest continuous ATV route, a circular one, in the west, and then some increased timber harvest on the front country. And so was that a perfect solution for everybody? Probably not, but is it a path forward that everybody can live with? Definitely. And so it's a way to figure out how we kind of look at a whole watershed or a whole landscape and make sure that we have management going forward that works for all.
10 years is a long time.
It is.
And what took 10 years?
Well, and think about when I talk about the diverse interests there at the table, and you think about, you know, maybe some of the old fights that used to happen where timber companies would never, ever utter the word new wilderness. And so in this proposal, there's 500,000 acres of new wilderness. On the flip side of that, there's other folks who didn't see the value in timber harvest that now are kind of saying, okay, we'll have this increased timber harvest in the front country if we can get this protection. So I think there's those things.
You're saying that takes time for people to get their head around.
It takes time for folks to understand that working together, you can find a solution that lasts the test of time. I think, you know, with other things, you know, where only one person wins, that's a pendulum to me. And so when it swings one way, yes, you may have a victory no matter where you are for a while. But once that pendulum swings the other way, you're going to have some pretty disastrous things that could happen to you. So I think it's better to work collaboratively.
Any other buckets?
So our last bucket is probably our hardest to define, and that's fair chase. It kind of came out of, you know, the ethic in the late 1800s on kind of the sportsman's ethic on how you hunt and why it's important. And so that's different in a lot of ways for anybody that's listening to this. Everybody has kind of different ethics, but there's those things that are so egregious that we see, like high-fenced hunting.
High-fenced hunting, meaning what?
So you're hunting ungulates mostly, so deer and elk behind a fence, an enclosure, and so they have no opportunity for escape. It's not fair chase. You know, I think that animal, it's going to die whether that's free or not, right? But I think it's what's fair to the hunt. And when you think about, you know, the opportunity for escape for that animal and just kind of the challenge that that provides, a fence is anything but that. And so I think that's one thing that stood out for us. Another example would be, you know, the use of drones for hunting and scouting.
Say that again.
Seems crazy, but you think about, you know, how drones were used in the military and then they started being used in civilian use. And right away, game wardens started seeing abuses of that where folks, you know, Brian Kahn could call me up and say, hey, Lan, I'm coming to Missoula. Let's go elk hunting. And I could say, all right, I'll get the drone up, get that bull in sight. And by the time you get there, I got a bull all picked out for you. I got a GPS coordinate and I can put you right on that bull. And so that was already happening.
My goodness.
And so we decided to get in front of that. And, you know, now we've banned drones for hunting and scouting during the hunting season for, I think, 14 states now.
Really? And is Montana one of them?
Montana was the second. Colorado was the first. But this was led, again, by our kind of local grassroots folks. The Boone and Crockett Club came on afterwards and said they would not accept any trophies that were taken this way. So that was a good backup for us. But really, the grassroots activism has been driven by BHA and something I'm proud of.
What kind of guy would hunt that way? What's the mentality in your assessment? You've been hunting all your life.
I think it's somebody that, you know, cares more about the bravado and having that big rack up on the wall rather than the, you know, the adventure and kind of challenge that brought them to that. And so you know, the antlers are the end-all be-all. And so that's very different than I think a lot of people in this country. But they get swept up in, you know, maybe some of the stuff on TV that you see and the high-fiving and the biggest rack. And so I think it's the industry that kind of pushes that.
I'm interested to hear you say BHA uses a fair amount of collaboration, because on your current website, when you talk about off-road vehicle abuse, or your words, it's pretty confrontational. I'm not criticizing or otherwise. I'm just saying we combat threats. We stand up to off-road vehicle abuse, as well as those that would abuse our habitat and water for commercial gain. There's not much reference in this current website to collaboration. When is each tactic appropriate in your judgment?
I think the key word is abuse. So when you think about hunting in general, we look at poachers and what they take from the people, and they're dealt with pretty swiftly by the general hunting public. And so I really want to, you know, when we couch OHV use, you know, I drive my truck to the trailhead, and a lot of our members use OHVs, but they do so in a legal and responsible manner. And so when folks start going around gates, or you know, riding through riparian zones that they're not supposed to be in, or you know, going around boulders or Kelly humps that are out there, those are the ones that are doing it illegally and abusing, and they should be held accountable. They're ruining it for all of us. And so just like poaching, we think they need to be dealt with swiftly and really stop kind of the bad perception that maybe that they're giving others.
When people get criticized as a group, they often get defensive. What's your experience with the ORV people when they hear you guys are basically saying some of you guys are bad actors?
I think, you know, they see the threats as well from those bad actors. And so I think they agree with us. You know, we have a reward that we give out for anybody that catches a abusive behavior, and we give out $500. And I think sometimes they see that as we're against all OHVs. But, you know, really it's about telling them that, no, it's against the abusive kind of illegal activity.
You recently had an event where there were 4,000 people. There was beer there. In case anybody wants to find out about your organization, how do they get hold of you?
I think there's two ways. One, just go to our website, backcountryhunters.org. You can Google Backcountry Hunters and Anglers as well. Or go to our Facebook page. We've got over 111,000 followers now on Facebook, and we update that 3 or 4 times a day. So it's a great way to get a good snapshot of who we are.
Who we are, meaning what compared with other conservation organizations?
First thing I would say is that we're the most hunting and fishing kind of organization out there. Folks that belong to organization don't just do it once or twice a year. This is something they think about or are doing 365. So that's the first piece. The other piece I would say is our demographics are much different. You know, our age group comes from the 20s all the way up to folks in their 70s. And so a lot of hunting and fishing organizations in this country are full of wise, kind of mature folks. But
tactfully put.
But don't have that connection to the youth and are trying to figure that out. We don't have to figure it out. We have it. And I think it's partly because of the word backcountry and how endearing that is right now and exciting to folks, the adventure and challenge, but also that we're standing up for our public lands and we're not out there, you know, to do anything else but protect and promote public lands. And so I think people, that resonates with folks and they want to get engaged.
Lantawny, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.